Okay.
I'm rolling.
Okay, this is an interview with Ellen Eggers on the Who Was Cesar Chavez project. And Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to know a little bit about your introduction to the UFW. How did you come to meet Cesar and join the UFW?
Well, I was in college. I was a social work major. It was my senior year of college back at Ball State University, Muncie, Indiana. Had never really, never been to California. And I barely knew who Cesar Chavez was. At the time, I remember kind of getting him mixed up with Che Guevara. Yeah. So that's how politically astute I was, not too much. I'd been very interested in the civil rights movement, though. And I was thinking of going to graduate school in social work and was looking for some summer volunteer work to do for the summer in between undergrad and graduate school. And a friend gave me a brochure that had lots of programs around the country, and one was the National Farm Worker Ministry out of Los Angeles, and it just had a tiny little blurb about working with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Union on the lettuce boycott. I think it was the lettuce boycott in Los Angeles. And, you know, to this day, I can't really quite tell you what attracted me to that, because it wasn't that I knew there was a lettuce boycott, because I didn't. But I applied for that position and was accepted and came out to work for the union for the summer through the National Farm Worker Ministry. And that was the organization that Chris Hartmeyer, Reverend Chris Hartmeyer, was in charge of. So it was just supposed to be kind of a summer volunteer gig, and I knew very little about it, but quickly started learning about it, and our job was to do house meetings and to tell other people about the farm workers and the boycott and the history of the union. And I had never met Cesar when I came out in June, but by August, that was the first I ever laid eyes on the man. And all the boycott organizers were asked to come to La Paz, to the headquarters, for a meeting. And I'm not even sure right now. It might have been because we knew that this Proposition 22 might qualify for the November ballot. It may have been gearing up for that. But I know it was in August. And, I think July or August that we all went to La Paz. And that was the first I ever saw Cesar. So, you know, after spending the summer telling lots of people about, you know, I had learned the history of the movement, how Cesar got started, and working with Fred Ross, and just all the details of how Cesar got involved and the sacrifices he made, and the strike and when the strike started, and how the Filipinos, you know, just all of the details, is that's what we learned over the summer and learned by talking to people. So when I first, I don't know that I actually even met Cesar then, but I was at a meeting that he was chairing and walked in and saw him.
So. Well, what was the image you, before meeting him, what was the image you had in your head of who this guy was?
Oh, Jesus Christ, basically. before I knew about him, I didn't know very much, obviously. But after 2 months of working on the boycott, I really did. I'll never forget when I walked into this conference room at La Paz. And, you know, we had all driven up from Los Angeles, so it was a couple-hour drive, and I really expected that we'd all gather and then Cesar would walk in, but it was the opposite. We walked in, and it was pretty much an empty room. We were starting to fill in, and he was sitting right there, you know, kind of ready to go, taking notes. And, I mean, I'll just never forget. I was just, like, stunned, and, I mean, I really felt like I was in the presence of a saint, or, you know, I mean, it was just bigger than anything I had ever been part of. I really was just in awe of him, like nobody else ever.
And when you got to talk to him, what was, did he become a human being, or what happened there?
Well, I'm trying to remember when I would have first spoken to him. It was probably a few months later in November. I'm not sure if I actually met him then. I mean, he was running the meeting, and I do remember, because I didn't speak to him at La Paz. You know, I sat there with my mouth open, I guess, and, you know, just listened to him speak, and he was running the meeting, and, you know, I can't even really remember what the meeting was about, but it was a very large group of us. It filled the place. There was 100 or 200 people probably. But I do remember probably the first time I ever talked to him would have been when we were celebrating the night that we won that proposition. Because I was planning to go home at the end of the summer, but then they asked, Leroy Chatfield was the one that asked all of us to stay on through November because the proposition was on the ballot. And so I was very reluctant to do it at first, but that was kind of the decision that changed the course of my life. And I just thought, yeah, I'm going to stay. And so we were celebrating winning that night. It was the night of the election, and we were ahead 60-40 on the proposition. And Caesar was just having a great time. We were all just kicking up our heels and dancing, and I danced with him. He asked me to dance, and he told me, I remember now, that he said, because that was the first I ever talked to him, and he said, I'll never forget you because I remember when you came to La Paz and you were sitting in the crowd. This is the first I've thought of that since, but that was it because, and I had to laugh because I thought, yeah, I'll bet you noticed me because I was probably sitting there just gawking, you know, like I was in heaven or something. But yeah, that was, so we danced and I remember people took pictures and the pictures didn't turn out. And I was always so like, oh, why can't I have a picture of myself dancing with Caesar? But yeah, that was that first summer.
Then you talked about the decision that changed your life. Tell me about that decision.
Well, I remember it was probably maybe the beginning. That meeting in La Paz was probably July because I think it was the beginning of August that Leroy met with all the LA boycott staff and said, you know, this is a life and death battle. This will be the end of the union if this proposition passes. And, you know, this we really need all the people to stay on through November. And I remember driving back with Ruth Shai. She was the head of our little segment. We lived up in the San Fernando Valley, and so we were going from L.A. back up to the Valley. And I know when we got in the car, she said to me, well, you're going to stay, aren't you? You'll stay. And I said, Ruth, you know I'm going back, you know. And my sister just had the first grandchild in the family, and my college roommate was getting married. And, I mean, to me it seemed out of the question. But in that half-hour drive back to the Valley, I remember I was sitting in the back seat of the car, and I thought, you know, here I spent the whole summer telling people about all the sacrifices Caesar made for the Union. And, you know, I just thought, 10 years from now, I may never remember if I went home in August or November. What's the big deal? But 10 years from now, I might remember whether I did the right thing or not. And so by the time we got to the Valley and we got out of the car, and I said, okay, Ruth, I'm going to stay. I remember I went right straight to a phone booth because I guess we couldn't make long-distance calls at the house. But I remember I went to the phone booth and I called my mother in Indiana and I was sobbing and crying and said, I'm staying. Because I really did want to go home, but I did feel like that was the right thing to do. And that actually, that decision ended up really, truly changing the course of my life because, you know, from then on I was kind of hooked on the Union after I stayed through the proposition. That really did it.
Now, though, what years were you at the Union, and you know, and how did, what were the different capacities you had?
Well, June of 72 was when I graduated from college and came out for that summer, and so I was 20. I hadn't turned 21 yet, but I turned 21 while I was on the boycott, and I was a boycott organizer. That was my title, and it was Los Angeles, and we were doing house meetings and picketing stores and getting people to help with the picket lines on the weekends. And then when the proposition work started up, that was a whole different campaign. We were registering voters and doing a lot of leafleting against the proposition and bumper stickering, you know, getting people to put bumper stickers on their cars. And then eventually we're doing the big billboards out on the freeways, the billboarding. And my mom actually came out for a week of that before the election. She said, well, if it's that important, then I should come out and help too. So she came out. And then, let's see, I did go back home for Christmas that year in 72, but I left my car in California, so I knew I wanted to come back. And then I was on the boycott for another 2 or 3 years. And then, let's see, at the end of 74, I was going to quit the Union and go to law school, but I only got home. I didn't get back in time to start law school in 74 because there was something else with the Union that I had to stay for. So I stayed, but then left. And and was going to go to law school. But as soon as I got back to Indiana, I was going to go the following year in 75 to law school, but I got a call from the union, and they wanted me to come out to do this big fundraising premiere because the documentary Fighting for Our Lives that was done of the strike, that was going to be shown. It was ready, and they wanted to make a big fundraising event out of it when it was shown for the first time, and they wanted me to come out and be one of the organizers for it. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. So since I wasn't in law school, I thought, yeah, I'll just come out for that. And so I did. So I, you know, I was only home for a couple months and turned right around and drove back out to California again. And but then I did, after that, I did go to law school then. So from 75 to 78, I was back in law school in Indiana. And but my whole plan to go to law school was to work for the union. And I had kind of decided that while I was on the picket lines for 3 years. You know, I just felt like if I loved the union and I wanted to stay with it, but I thought I need to do it in some other capacity. And so I really loved what Jerry Cohn was doing and thought that looked like exciting work. And so I did go to law school, and I always I came out during the summers and told Caesar, you know, I said, you know, when I get finished with law school, Caesar, I'm going to come and work for the volunteer wages, because the lawyers at that time were the only ones that got paid. They were getting $600 a month. And I used to always say, why do the lawyers get money? You know, we should, everybody should just be on the volunteer stipend. Well, I didn't know that that was like a big hot button issue with him too. I just said it, you know, but so he was grooving on that pretty well when I was saying, yeah, you know, I'll come out and work for free. And he was like, yeah, that's my girl, you know? And so, when I did finish with law school, then I came back out to the union, and but unbeknownst to me, there had been this big upheaval then. So anyway, and that had to do with the lawyers and pay and how much they'd be paid and where they'd work and all of that. And so when I came, though, I did, and the lawyers were all working on the volunteer stipend. So that was good. I mean, I felt that was the right thing to do. And I did that then for 7 years. I was at the headquarters at La Paz.
Okay.
And then left in 1987.
Okay. Well, let's step back a little bit, because I do want to get to some of this other history of the union, but I want to talk a little bit about Caesar.
Yeah.
And let's talk about Caesar and who this guy was. And I just want to get a sense of, you know, what was he like to be around? Was he a serious guy? Was he fun? Or what?
Well, you know, like anybody, he could be fun, serious, nasty, cutting. Well, you know, when I was on the boycott, I mean, I think he really loved the boycotters, because we were like the people out there in the trenches, you know. And I think that, you know, those first few years with the union, well, I mean, that first year in 72, he knew who I was, and I knew him, of course, and, you know, our paths would cross. And so after I had met him in that way, I mean, I think that dancing with him was the first time we ever talked, but he would always go out of his way to say hello to me, and I was just nuts about him. I was just crazy about him. I thought, I mean, he was always really nice, really solicitous, really interested in you. You know, I mean, he just was that way with people. And very sweet and charming, just sweet, charming, good, a leader, admirable. I mean, there just wasn't anything that I could see about him that was negative at all. And I just loved him to pieces. I mean, I remember as a boycotter thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do when Caesar dies? What will my life be like when he's not, you know, somebody there in my life? And I think a lot of people felt that way about him. I mean, just admired the heck out of him, you know. And he was really sweet. Now, then when I really got to know him, where he was my boss, because on the boycott, I mean, he's sort of everybody's boss, but he wasn't my direct supervisor. He was just our leader coming in to check on things or whatever. He would be in LA for some reason or another, and we were all just kind of his adoring fans, and he kind of adored us back. And but when I worked at La Paz for the first summer, that would have been the summer of 76, I guess, because I had been in law school for that first year of law school. And I came My sister and her husband then were working for the union too. I kind of got them interested, and they came out with their kids, and they were living at La Paz. And so I specifically asked Jerry Cohen from the legal department if I could have a legal department job but work in La Paz, where my sister was. And so he said, yeah, that'll work out fine. Here's what we can do. You will be this new position called legal liaison, because the legal department was in Salinas. So I was sort of like the administrative person for the legal department to be their rep in La Paz with Caesar. And so one of the things I had to do was prepare the budget for the legal department and then get Caesar's approval on it. And I'll never forget the first time that this is like my first real meeting with Caesar, like, you know, my first interaction, just Caesar and me. And I was so excited. I mean, it was like, oh, my God. Because when I was on the boycott, I used to think this would be a dream come true to be working for the union, but in La Paz. Because when you're out on the boycott, and you're out standing in front of a Safeway store, and you're just getting beat up. I mean, you know, verbally abused by people all day long. Get out of my way. Go back to Russia. Or, you know, oh, is that that Cesar Chavez again? And I mean, not everybody, but you really remember the people that are mean to you. And so I thought, oh, if I could work in the union in some capacity where I'd be at La Paz, where everybody I see supports the union, that would be heaven, you know. I think about this now. It's kind of funny in a way. But so anyway, this was my dream job, you know, to be working for the union right at the headquarters. And oh my gosh, now this is my first meeting with Caesar. So I had just been on the phone with Jerry Cohen, who was really my boss because he's the legal department man and head of the legal and up in Salinas. And what he had wanted into the budget, which I had put in, was, I think, for 3 or 4 new IBM Selectric typewriters. Those were the top of the line at the time, you know. And Jerry said, we got to have these, you know, we got these old clunkers, and we, you know. So this was a new item in the budget. And I was supposed to be pushing for it and making sure that they got these 3 typewriters. So I was like, yeah, yeah, because Jerry was always kind of my hero, you know. Yeah, yeah, okay, Jerry, I got it, you know. So I go into Caesar's office. And, you know, I'm sure I was, like, nervous and excited. And the first thing, I mean, he's looking over the budget, and just right off the bat, he's like, well, they're not getting these typewriters. I mean, that was, like, the first thing he saw was this big item. It was probably $600 or something. It was like, no way, they're not getting these. And just the first thing out of my mouth was, are you sure? And, oh, my God, he had these little glasses on his nose, these little half glasses, and they fell down. And he just looked at me like this, and he goes, fucking A, yes, I'm sure. I was so startled. I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I mean, A, that he was swearing, and B, that he was swearing at me. And I was, like, just so flabbergasted because I'd always thought of him as this saintly, holy, dear, sweet man, and he was just like a bear, you know? But now looking back, I think, yeah, who the heck was I? This little white girl coming in and asking him if he's sure about a budget item. Yeah, fucking yes, I'm sure, you know? So that was like, okay, I guess I'm not going to be doing that again. But that was my first meeting with Caesar, and, you know, that certainly was the other side of his personality. I mean, he could just be tough as nails and hard-nosed and stubborn and a jerk and, you know, just like all the rest of us, you know. But
a human being.
Yeah. But I mean, he was the head of the union, and he was in a very powerful position, and he had lots of people that wanted to please him and that loved him. And, you know, I think there's no question that that affects people. I mean, you'd have to be... You really would have to be a saint for that not to affect you. And I think that, you know, I've heard people say that back in the early days before I was there, so in the late, you know, mid to late 60s when he was really getting started, that Caesar really sought out criticism, really wanted people's, you know, tell me the truth, that kind of thing. And it may have been Jerry or somebody else that told me years later, you know, he used to be like that, but now he really doesn't want to hear the truth, you know.
But what happened? I mean, you were saying that at first Caesar sought out criticism and later he didn't. What changed there, or what were the circumstances?
Well, you know, it would just have to be my opinion on this. I don't really know, but I suspect it was a lot of things. I suspect it was, you know, at the beginning, you're just starting out. You're a nobody. Nobody knows you. You're not famous. You just got an idea, and you're determined, and you're going to give it a shot. You know, I mean, what he told Helen, let's try it for 10 years or something, you know. And, but then over time, you know, you do become known, and you have built something, and people recognize that you've got something here, and they see the importance of it, and he does too, and now it becomes really important to preserve it and not to lose what you've gained. And you've seen a lot more, and maybe you've seen people that you think are betraying you or betraying the cause or going off in their direction that isn't good for your cause. I mean, it's almost like his baby. That was his child, you know, that he birthed, and got probably more protective about it. And not so willing to give up control, or, I mean, I can kind of see that, you know. I mean, as a mother, we tend to want to control all the stuff to protect our children, you know, so that they're never hurt, and that was probably a lot of the same instincts that were guiding him. And, you know, beyond that, you know, I don't know. I think that would be some of the stuff that affected him.
Well, he became powerful in the union, and he became famous, and he became an international celebrity. How did he handle that? Did it all go to his head, or was he still somewhat of a modest person?
I think he was still really modest. Yeah. Yeah, I never saw him as a big blowhard or braggart or, no, I mean, no, not at all. I think he was still really humble and modest and sweet and kind. I mean, even the years that I was at La Paz, where he was the boss and kind of the mayor of the town, you know, when it came to daycare and child care issues and just stuff that had nothing to do with farm workers, but where he had the say in things. And I remember when I got pregnant, I was 29 and got pregnant accidentally, wasn't married. One of the other lawyers that worked for the union was my child's father, but it was a surprise. And, you know, when I went to tell Caesar that I was pregnant, I mean, he was just so sweet. He got tears in his eyes, and, you know, I kind of expect him to go, oh, my God, how could you be so dumb? Aren't you 29 years old? Don't you know about birth control? But, you know, he didn't at all. He got tears in his eyes and said something like, you know, that's the greatest thing a person can do is to have a child, you know, or having children is the greatest thing that human beings can do, something like that, you know. But he was very philosophical and touched by it, and I think I probably got tears in my, I'm sure I would have gotten tears in my eyes, but I think he did too. I mean, my recollection is that he did, and I think that's what I've told people over the years. I mean, that I don't have a real clear memory of it, but I think that's what I recall. And I think it surprised me, you know, that he would be that way about it. So, yeah, he always was just, there were times when I had to travel with him, like if we had depositions to do in a case, and so we'd travel maybe 4 or 5 hours together in the car, and he really loved to talk about the boycott days and trade stories, and, you know, I liked it because it gave me an opportunity to tell him some of the stuff that was happening on the boycott, just unusual stories or funny things that happened, and he totally loved to hear about it. I mean, there was no way that he could have known some of the stuff that was just happening day to day on the ground, but he seemed genuinely into it, and he'd laugh and say, oh, man, you know, we have got to write a book someday. You know, we got to get all these boycott stories down someday, you know, so that people can see this. So in a way, that's sort of happening with what the Project Leroy's doing.
Now, we're doing a number of other interviews. Among them was Richard Ibarra and Larry Tramatola and Chris Hartmeyer and Leroy, and you're the fifth person here. We haven't interviewed Chris yet, but what among this group of folks, of organizers and boycott leaders, what was that like to be among that group? And how did you guys, did you guys bond and become close?
Well, everybody that you've named, I would say the person that I know the best of all those people is Chris Hartmeyer. He was the very first person I ever met because he ran the farm worker ministry. So my first contact with anybody from the movement was Chris. And so while I was a boycott staff person, if I had a problem or a question or a worry or whatever, he would be the person I go to because he was sort of the person that brought me into it. And he has become my mentor for just many purposes over the years. I mean, he's just somebody I dearly love. And I remember thinking years ago when Caesar was still alive and I was with the union that, I thought, I adore Caesar. And I just, he's up on a pedestal like nobody else. But I thought between Chris and Caesar, Chris is the one that, that I'm really bonded with personally because... when Caesar would do things that I didn't agree with or didn't understand or couldn't understand how he could be so harsh and kind of cold-blooded with some people, just like he'd cut them off and that was it. I didn't want to feel bad about what Caesar had done, so I go ask Chris, and Chris would always be the one that would say, well, Ellen, you got to look at it from Caesar's perspective. He's got the whole union to run, and... he's not just focusing on that one person. He's got to kind of move things forward. And he would explain things that way for me. So Chris was kind of my number one favorite person in the movement. And Richard Ybarra was always somebody I really liked a lot. I got to know him because he would be traveling with Caesar when Caesar would come down to the boycott to Los Angeles. And so I got to know Richard really well and became friends with Richard. And I always liked him a lot. But didn't see him as much as Chris. And then, and Leroy was he was the first boycott coordinator. He was in charge of the LA campaign when I first came on. So I'm trying to think how that worked. I guess, I was with the migrant ministry, but then Leroy was the staff person in charge of all of that. So.
Now, Caesar, we've heard this before, Caesar would have a falling out or something would happen and people, he would cut people out. What was that? I mean, now looking back, as an adult, what was that?
Well, of course, Caesar had this whole thing with Chris, and that's kind of a whole separate deal because I think I to this day I don't really understand how. And I confronted Caesar about that in 1990. After I'd been away from the union for 3 years, Caesar came to Sacramento for a rally, and I was working for the State Employees Union then, and they were sort of doing the advance work for Caesar's rally that day. So they were all saying, oh, Ellen, Caesar's going to be here. Don't you want to go? And I was kind of like, because I was pretty upset with what he had done with Chris. But
And well, maybe you could explain a little bit about what happened.
Well,
to people listening.
There was... I left the union in 87, and Chris was still with the union, and there had been this money that turned up missing, and it was this guy Bryce Basie had embezzled like thousands, I don't know how much, maybe like $100,000 had been embezzled, and technically Chris was sort of like that guy's supervisor, but at that time Caesar had put Chris in charge of three big, huge departments and projects, and so Chris was not in a position to be micromanaging every voucher that came through, and you kind of trust that when the accountant says we need this signed off on, you just kind of sign the voucher. But, technically, Chris had signed off vouchers that were part of that embezzlement. But, it's just preposterous that anybody would have thought Chris was involved in it. But for some reason, Caesar decided to make Chris the scapegoat for it, but... I mean, that's a whole story in itself. But to make a long story short, Caesar put Chris kind of on a leave of absence, and when Chris kept trying to call him to get input or find out what was going on, he wasn't returning his phone calls, and pretty soon it was pretty clear that, he was out after 30 years of being this completely 100% faithful servant of the union. So it was the ultimate act of cold-bloodedness on Caesar's part. And I had been gone from the union for a couple of years by then. I left on good terms. There, you know, it was totally cool when I left. But when that happened, that just, I just could not believe it. So I went to this rally, and I watched Caesar, and I really wanted to come up to him. And I had actually had a phone conversation with Caesar a few months before that, because he called me at my office where I was working because he had some question about a file. And it shocked me because, you know, the phone rang, and I hadn't been with the union for a couple of years, and I pick up the phone, and it's Caesar. And, I mean, just hearing his voice just kind of did something to me. Even though I was mad at him for what he had done, I heard his voice, and it just kind of melted me because he sounded tired like he kind of always did. I mean, he always worked very hard, and he was quiet and kind of, you know, kind of worn out. I mean, when he wasn't all fired up, but he sounded tired, and he immediately just evoked this feeling in me like I wanted to help him, just like I always did, just like, what can I do to help? I want to support you, you know? And he was asking about a file, and as much as I wanted to kind of snub him, I just couldn't, you know, I was, it just took the wind out of my sails, and it kind of surprised me, and I was a little bit terse with him. I mean, I didn't fawn over him like I would normally. If I would have, oh, Caesar, hi, oh my God, it's so good to talk to you. I didn't do any of that. So when I saw him at this rally a few months later, I came up to him, and he was really nice, and oh, hi, and he grabbed my hand, and oh, and I said, oh, it's nice to see you too, Caesar. And I said, you know, I hope I didn't sound funny on the phone when you called. Oh, no, no, no. And I said, well, it was really good to hear your voice. And I said, but Caesar, I got to ask you something. I said, I really don't understand how you could do what you did to Chris Hartmeyer. And he just like turned completely. I mean, I've told people this story, and he kind of like went from St. Francis to Darth Vader, like just like that, you know. He was like, what did I do to Chris Hartmeyer? You tell me right now, what did I do to Chris Hartmeyer? I said, well, you put him on a leave of absence and didn't return his phone calls. I mean, you basically kicked him out. I didn't kick him out of the union. Artie, tell him, you know, because Artie Rodriguez was standing there, and he's like, but I mean, I had already heard the whole story from Chris. I mean, he was called into a board meeting, and, you know, just they had planned it all ahead of time to just go after him. And, I mean, he was completely innocent. You know, the other guy was, I think, convicted and sent to prison. And, you know, he had been embezzling, and Chris knew nothing about it. But I think somehow the board members justified what Caesar did as a necessity. And, I mean, I don't get it. You know, it was like there had to be a fall guy, so I guess it had to be Chris. I don't know. Yeah. I don't understand that kind of thinking. But Caesar and I really got into it there on the street. You know, we were out on the sidewalk in front of the Capitol in Sacramento. And I just kind of stuck with him, and he didn't want to hear it. And he just got really snotty with me and got very insulting to me and got insulting to Jerry and insulting the lawyers. And, you know, he just got over the top. But I just stuck with him. I just followed him to his car. I walked down about 3 blocks. By the time we got to the car, you know, I was crying, and he was making fun of me and saying things like, oh, your crocodile tears don't oppress me. And, you know, I just saying mean stuff, you know. But I didn't care because I had something to say to him, and there weren't too many people that were in a position that A, knew the inside story of what he did, and B, you know, wasn't still with the union to where you wouldn't have wanted to do that, because it would have meant, you know, the end of your relationship with him and the union. So, I mean, I was outside the union and could say it, and yet inside enough that I knew, you know, I knew all the stuff and all the things that he said. I mean, he said hurtful things that I knew were not true. I knew they weren't true that he said to me. And, I just didn't let it bother me, but I felt good that I had confronted him about it, because it had been bugging me for at least a year. I think it was a year before that he did that. So that was my last dealing ever with Caesar before he died. And, you know, I don't have regrets about it, because I felt like I said what I wanted to say to him, and he was angry. And I would say that would be one of Caesar's characteristics, is that, I mean, it didn't really bother me, because I knew he was just saying mean things to hurt me. He was trying to be hurtful.
But this, you know, this doesn't sound like the same man that you met. What did you see that there was a change in Caesar? Was he paranoid, or had he gotten tougher? I mean, you said that he was saying things to be hurtful. What was the purpose of it?
Well, he felt, you know, I mean, it's, he was angry, and, you know, maybe he did have second thoughts about what he did, but I think at the time he did it, he must have thought he was doing the right thing and he was going to be decisive, and I don't know. Something made him decide that that was the course that had to be taken for the good of the Union, I suspect. And he probably did, I don't know, he probably did have mixed feelings about it, or maybe I was the first one that had ever taken him on. I don't think so, though, because I'll bet that his wife Helen didn't like it. She was crying when the Hartmeyers left La Paz, you know, and I bet there were other family members of Caesar's that didn't really like it either. I feel sure that's the case. But he was the boss, and, you know, I don't know if anybody else ever questioned him about it. But the people on the board that I talked to after that happened to Chris were clear that, you know, they were toeing the line as far as this is the line we're using and this is the line we're going with and it must be right. And they just didn't question it or allow themselves to question it. So, you know, I don't see that Caesar getting mad and being hurtful like that was anything so different than any of us as human beings do from time to time when we feel under pressure or stressed or not in a good mood or feel threatened or feel attacked. I was attacking him not in a really vicious way, but in a very direct, and, you know, I wasn't going to back down. I really didn't go after him. I was respectful. But just, I truly wanted an answer. I couldn't figure it out. And so it was more just saying, Caesar, I don't understand this. And he'd say, well, da 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 da. And I'd say, but Caesar, that's not the case because la 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 la. And he'd say, well, you don't understand because of that. And I'd say, but no. And so he was just getting frustrated. I mean, I was cross-examining him in a very nice way, and it was getting him really pissed off, and he decided he was going to let me have it, and he just started unloading on me. So, you know, I wasn't it. I mean, in the scheme of humanity, we all do things like that. It, you know, it was kind of a big deal to me because it was something I cared about. But getting back to your question, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there at the beginning, and, you know, throughout the period of the Union's, like, say, 1965 to 1985, I was present and involved and in some ways in a significant way with Caesar during a few of those years, but not throughout all those years. So I'm not really in a position to say, well, he used to be like this in 62, but by 72 he was like this. You know, I mean, my perspective was as a young woman that adored this great figure that I thought was doing wonderful things and I admired and learned so much from. And that part really didn't change. I mean, I got to see him more as a human being and as a guy that makes mistakes and can get angry and can be kind of snotty and bossy and smart alecky and, you know, inflexible. But I still admired him, and I still to this day, you know, okay. I really do.
Okay. Now, you were around in La Paz for a long time, and you were around his family. How was he with Helen and with the kids? I'm sure she didn't let him get away with a lot.
You know, I can't really answer that question. I know she talked about, you know, I would be in situations where Helen would be, you know, like any wife rags on her husband, you know, oh, Caesar said that, rah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. But I was never really privy to their relationship and how they interacted with each other. Or, you know, I never heard him say things disrespectful of Helen. I felt like he had a lot of respect for her. You know, I mean, Yeah, I'm not in very much of a position. Yeah. There were other people that were closer with Helen.
Okay.
I mean, I was a young white woman that had a baby out of wedlock. So, you know, that probably didn't cut too much with Helen. I know it didn't. I mean, I just know it didn't. And she was nice to me one time when, I mean, not that she was unnice to me, but I had, when my son was about three, I got involved in this trial at the border down in El Centro that went for, basically it spanned about 3 years. And it was a huge sacrifice for me. It really was. And, you know, I had to take my son with me and I was traveling back and forth for a while. I couldn't take him with me. And, you know, I mean, it was a strain for a young mom to be doing that. And, she came up to me one time when I was back in La Paz, and it was really nice, and I appreciate it. And she said, you know, I really want to thank you for all the sacrifices you've made for the union. I know this has been really hard, you know, doing this trial. And I said, oh, thanks. And I, you know, I appreciated that because I think she probably, you know, there was... I just happen to know what kind of woman Helen is. You know, she's a strong, tough, old... matriarch farm worker Mexican woman, and you know she doesn't take kindly to girls getting pregnant out of wedlock. You know, I mean, that's not that different from a lot of women, but I think Mexican women, and of course not all her daughters were married at the time they got pregnant, I don't think, but you know, anyway, so, but I don't really know about Ben. I mean, he was crazy about his kids and his grandkids and spent time with them, and there were lots of family gatherings, and yeah. But I don't know too much about how he interacted with the family.
But you talked a little bit about when, you know, when you first met him, and you know, you danced with him. How was he? You know, was there, you know, in your time at La Paz? Did you see him that at other times when he just kind of like relaxed and let his hair down? Did he like to have a good time, or was he serious?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No. I would say he liked to have a good time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, he was always funny and telling jokes, and you know, he liked the attention. He was very social, you know, and yeah, he was not like a quiet, mousy. Yeah, in that sense, like the saintly part. No, I mean, around La Paz, he was very much, he loved to tell stories, and he was funny, and he was charming, and, you know, everybody was really crazy about him. So who wouldn't do well in that situation, you know? When you're living at the headquarters where everybody there thinks you're pretty groovy, but, you know, it was good, and I think he was very happy there.
What about his leadership ability? Did he have something special that made him a leader? Did he have certain skills? What was it that you know that gave him that charisma or that gravitas that had people following him?
Well, he knew what he was doing. I mean, he really he was a trained, top-notch organizer. You know, he really came up from the bottom. He learned how to organize at that really small grassroots level, and he just kept going with it, and it kept working. And, you know, probably history was just the right time, right place, and all of that it came together. But he had the skills to do it, and he really was one of the best organizers around, and the people that came out of the union learned how to be some of the best organizers around. What I know about organizing, I learned every bit of it in the Farm Workers Union. And I was somebody that when I was graduating from college, you know, I was going to be a social worker, but the one thing that made me afraid to be a social worker is I thought, what if sometime I'm asked to speak to a college class and I have to get up in front of a class and speak? I don't think I could do that. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing I couldn't do. And, you know, now, I mean, as a lawyer, you have to be a speaker, but I do public speaking, and I learned to do that in the Farm Workers Union from doing organizing and from knowing how to talk to people and what to say to them to get them involved and get them interested and kind of leading by example. And that's really what Caesar did. He was also extremely well-read. He was, I mean, for having a sixth grade education, he had this huge library in his office and he read a lot. He was constantly reading about new ideas and, you know, he was always thinking of new things. Let's try this. Let's try that. And of course, you know, by the time I was in the union and he was famous, why, if he had a new idea, there was always lots of people to follow it and give it a try, you know. So he had the ability to carry out a lot of his ideas. But what made him... Well, I think he had a very determined quality about him. And I know that when you let other people see that you're going to do something, whether they help you or not, or whether you're the only person that's doing it or not, when people understand that about you, it's like a magnet. They just want to be part of it because they see that this is, you know, okay, this guy's going to do something. And if, you know, people want to be part of something that's getting done. And he definitely communicated that just dogged kind of stick-to-itiveness, you know, that he was going to see it through.
Right. Now, you said your mother and your sister came out for a while, and what was their take? What was on Caesar? When did they think you were doing the right thing by
phone? Yeah.
Or tell me about that.
Well, my mother had been involved in the civil rights movement back in Indiana, and so my family, you know, they thought it was a good thing. My dad was kind of always saying, okay, well, you've put in your time now. Don't you think it's time to come home and get a real job? And he would sort of say things like that. But my mom thought it was really good. And I remember one time I came home during the summer. It was probably after I'd been with the union for about a year. And she had this note on my dresser, my bedroom, that said, see, I was supporting Caesar in the union before you were. And she had cut a thing out of Newsweek magazine about the great boycott. And I remember that now, that when I was in high school, one time I said, we haven't had any grapes. And she said, well, we're not supposed to eat grapes, something about migrant workers. And I just vaguely remember that. So my mom had known about it. That would have been maybe 67, probably. So she knew that there was a great boycott when I didn't, and so she reminded me about it. So she was very supportive, and I don't know if my mom really ever got to meet Caesar. She might have, but she was only out for a couple weeks. But my sister and her husband and their two kids came out, and they lived at La Paz for about a year. And she really loved Caesar, too. She worked, it's my older sister, she was working doing letters for Caesar, doing his correspondence when people would write, and then she'd write the letters back for him. And she's really good at that. She was an English major, and she's very good at writing, and he really liked it, and she really liked that he liked it. She was kind of grooving on that job. Her husband wanted to leave to go back to Pennsylvania, so they eventually left. But yeah, she was very hooked on it.
Now, you said that you know, when you left, I guess was what, 87. What did you, at that point when you left, did you feel I'm going to come back later, or this is over? What were your feelings?
I was ready to go. I didn't have like bitter feelings, but I have to say I'd been 7 years in La Paz, so I did get to see Caesar up close and personal, and I hate to say this, but I did. I started, you know, and I don't, you know, I just feel like if the Chavez family hears this or sees this, I don't mean any disrespect to him or the family or anything, but I did begin to feel like Caesar was kind of spinning his wheels, like this was kind of going nowhere. And, you know, you can give up a lot and not make money and, you know, live poorly and do whatever. I mean, it was never a sacrifice for me, but at least, you know, when you feel like it's going in the right direction, you can do that. But when you start having doubts about whether it's making a difference, you can't. And I started feeling like, I just seen too much of him wanting to start things. And I don't really blame him for this particularly. I mean, there's some things I blame him for, but a lot of it was just, you know, how long can you sustain this fever pitch of emotion? You know, the boycott was run because the country got behind it. And, you know, the public is, they're not going to be like, I'm on this big time bandwagon. You know, you got to keep coming up with new ideas for getting them on board. And or you got to do something else. And, of course, a lot of people thought he should just get down and make it more a serious business-type union with people with salaries and not a social cause and movement anymore. And that became a big debate about whether to have paid salaries or volunteer salaries. And I didn't mind not being paid, but it was more just feeling like, where is this going? Does he have direction? Does he know what he's doing? Can we get what we need? You know, Duke Majan, I think, was governor then, and, you know, the ALRB was going all to hell. And, you know, we were losing ground, and I think Caesar kept trying to come up with new ideas for getting it started again and getting it moving and getting contracts back and building the union and enforcing the contracts and succeeding, you know, being a successful union and growing. And I think he kept trying, but I, for one reason or another, I don't think he was getting very far. And then that, you know, I could have forgiven him for that, but I kept seeing him kind of start projects and then drop them and then start something else and drop that and start this and drop that. And it became like there were these rocks, these river rocks, big rocks that were sitting out at the entrance of La Paz that had been there for about 5 years. Because when I first came there, we used to do these Saturday work days and he'd get us out and we'd be digging gardens and doing, you know, projects outside. And one of the things he wanted to do was build this big brick wall. And, oh, we measured it all out and marked it with string and brought up all these heavy rocks from down the creek bed. And they sat there, you know, until I left. I mean, they were still out there. And it would just, you know, I was like, I wanted to finish the wall. He got us all going on it. And that just kind of became symbolic of starting things and then letting it go and getting everybody fired up. Okay, we're all going to stop what we're doing. And for the next 3 months, we're going to do this. And we'd drop our project and work on this. And then he'd start something else. And I mean, just over time, I saw him do things that I just thought was not the best judgment or was being stubborn just to be stubborn. Some of the lawsuits that I thought should have been handled this way and not that way and, you know, just made wrong decisions on things, on how to proceed with them. And after a time, just all these things put together, I just started losing faith. And I stayed through this giant big lawsuit that happened down at the border until my son, he was 3 when we started and he was almost 6 when the suit was over with. And by then I had another baby, Teresa, my daughter. And so as soon as the year before that, I started sending out applications to unions in different places. You know, I thought a transition would be into another union, but to leave the union and go do something else. And, it just so happened that right when that trial ended, I got a response back from one of the people that I had applied to the year before saying, oh, we now have an opening. Are you still interested? And so I took the job and I moved to Sacramento. And, you know, I was just glad to be gone at that point. I mean, there were some things I was going to miss, but I really had lost faith. Yeah. Just didn't have that enthusiasm for it anymore.
What changed, though? Because you seem to be positive and have some, you know, good memories and some not-so-good memories. How did you work all this out in your own head, your feelings about the union, your feelings about Caesar?
Well, when I left in 87, none of this stuff with Chris had happened, and Chris was still with the union. And Caesar had the fast the year after that in 88, and I came to Delano when he did the fast. And I was still doing stuff in Sacramento for the union. I had gotten the union that I went with, CSEA, to print up bumper stickers that said boycott grapes, and I would go out and with other people and put them on, you know, on the weekend. So I was still a supporter, and I was still doing things for the Farm Workers Union, and I still identified with the cause. So I wasn't bitter or down on it or what a loser, or, you know, but I just thought, for me, I just need to move on. I mean, it would take me a minute to really think what I was feeling then, but I still had okay feelings, and I left on good terms. They used to always say, oh, when you leave the union, you can't possibly leave on good terms because Caesar takes it personally and he will basically write you off. And so I kind of expected that that might happen. And I understood that too. You know, it's like the union was so personal to him. It was his life. It was, you know, it was his identity. And for somebody to leave was kind of like saying, eh, I don't think this is good anymore, when he thought it was really good and he wanted you to stay, you know. So I could understand, but, and I didn't. They had like a little going away party, and I can't remember if he was there or not, but he might not have been. But, it didn't matter. He signed the little flag. I got the little union flag, and everybody signed it, you know, and he signed it too. And so I left on good terms, and it was all okay. But then when that stuff happened with Chris, it made me really angry with him. But I got it off my chest with the confrontation, and then, you know, it was just a few years after that that he suddenly up and died, and that was a big shock. But, you know, it didn't devastate me like I always thought it would. You know, I remember thinking back, like in 72, how am I ever going to possibly survive if Caesar's dead? You know, and
but
by the time he died, I was just like, well, he kind of disappointed me. In time, I mean, what I say now and what I really believe is he changed the course of my life. He changed the course of history for farm workers. He changed thousands of the lives of just, you know, white middle-class folks like me that came to work for a summer or a few years. I mean, there's no question about it. He was a fabulous leader. He is worthy of admiring and respecting and adoring and writing books about. He's worthy of all of it, you know, and I am thrilled that not a bit of that time that I was with the union do I regret at all. You know, it was all worth every bit of my time, and I'm very proud of the time that I was there. But he wasn't perfect, and he had some serious flaws. But, you know, it doesn't take away from the good that he did. Some people, you know, like Marshall Gans, for example, who was more, you know, directly involved with the organizing up in Salinas and some of the stuff that Caesar did that directly impacted on his work. And, you know, that whole, I don't know if you know about the stuff that happened in Salinas. I mean, Marshall's got a whole different take because that really directly impacted on his beliefs and his work and his day-to-day, you know, nitty-gritty activities that he cared about with the union, the same things that Caesar cared about. And it just, you know, it turned very sour and ugly. And, you know, so for people that were affected in that way, you know, I empathize with how they must feel about it and how much it must make them fairly bitter. Maybe Marshall's not bitter, but I think I would be bitter if I was in his shoes. And, you know, I didn't have to experience any of that direct wrath from Caesar. We had some run-ins when I was at La Paz a couple of times, but it was over non-policy stuff. It was like daycare stuff, you know? So, you know, there are some people that I'm sure would have much harsher criticism about Caesar's place in history. But I think even those people, even Marshall, will certainly admit that Caesar, you know, did way more good than he did bad.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, Ellen? Anything else that you'd like to share with us? Because I think we covered a lot of territory, and you speak very much from the heart. Anything else that we missed?
Well,
any other stories, just to kind of shed a little light on this very, very complicated person?
Well, I'm not thinking of anything right now. I mean, there's other stories, but, you know, they're little negative stories, and they're things that happened in the context of my representation of him and the union as his lawyer. And, you know, I've been told that I should keep my mouth shut about that. I don't know if it's still attorney-client privileged or not.
But some big picture things. Yeah, big picture things. And you just kind of reveal, you know, the person, Caesar is a human being.
Well, you know, I think we've hit on all of them. He was sweet. He was humble. He was charming. He was funny. he was just very much a regular guy and a nice guy and down to earth on the one hand. On the other hand, he was tough as nails, hard-nosed, inflexible, and bossy, you know?
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview.
Oh, yeah, it was fun.
Nice meeting you.
Yeah, you too.
Okay.
And you too. Now I've forgotten your name already.
It's Marisa.
Marisa, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. So Chris is yet to come up. He was just in the...